So Sunil has forced me in front of this as well, because if I stayed back there, I would have been sort of metaphorically putting something
looks,
in between.
He looks scared there.
Yeah. And also going, making me go third was, you know, that's pretty sneaky. Sunil and I have done now 5 presentations together, and, you know, I keep figuring out that this is what he's doing each time. He's stealing my fodder, you know, before I get to go. You know, we come at this from slightly different viewpoints. I did this in part because I was given this role of innovation leader at PwC about 2 years ago. And other than meaning that you get to wear funky socks sometimes, and, you know, my job within PwC is to create growth opportunities. So new revenue for PwC. We know that, you know, across our 155 different territories we work in, we are facing price pressure on the audits that we perform. We think that our tax work is actually going to be usurped by software automation. And we are struggling with this idea that we have 200,000 employees right now. And if you think about sort of the seasonal nature of our work, it is very difficult for us to be thinking about, is that really the proper structure for the future? So about, call it 13 months ago, I was invited to do a speech at a conference about disruption in financial services. And I was going to look at the latest reports from PwC, even the stats that Sunil quoted. You stole those as well. Nice job. And so, you know, I could have done all of that, but I decided I was going to go hands-on to a side of the sharing economy that most people don't do. I actually signed up to be an UberX driver in the first wave in Toronto, September 22nd. I went through the whole process of signing up to be an UberX driver. And I've completed maybe about 150 trips. And what I'm going to share with you is a little bit of the lessons that I learned on the supply side, and then try to give you sort of the extrapolation I've done since then. This is the, you know, just to prove that, you know, there was actually, you know, a picture of me. I was a 4.87. It went down slightly over Halloween, which I will explain is a bit of a challenge for God. So, you know, this is my corporate picture that I used for driving. A lot of people were a little, you know, unsure what was happening. One guy thought that his boss was coming to pick him up. But so... You know, I thought that understanding, as Sunil said, this $60 billion company with 3,000, maybe 4,000 employees, I think something like 3/4 of those employees are actually data scientists. The rest are lobbyists. you know, how are they able to get this astronomical valuation with that sort of full-time footprint? And sort of how are they using people like me and my own personal car to create value in the system. So let me talk to you a little bit about sort of what I saw firsthand. So when I signed up, everything was done with my mobile phone. So I took pictures of the inside of my car, the outside of my car, and I like to tell people that my wife was overjoyed that I had to clean up the inside of our car in order to qualify. I took pictures of my driver's license, my insurance, more about the insurance in a little bit, and I uploaded all of that information to Uber's driver portal. So after doing all that, it took about 30 minutes, I was able to be picked up for the last step, which is the ID verification. So they actually send a limo for you. They give you credit for a Uber Black to kind of pick you up and take you to a local hotel. And so I joined a group of people, probably at that stage it was probably about 40 in this particular intake. There was husband and wife teams, there was retired people, there was younger people. One young man who was sitting next to me put up his hand during the early question and answer and said, you know, I've got a misdemeanor from university, I was spray painting, I was drunk, but that's not going to count against me, right? That's not a problem. Sure enough, they said we have a zero tolerance, and he was out there, you know, within seconds. They said, sorry, you know, we can't accept you. And it was interesting for me after having read some of what was happening in the United States in terms of, you know, are they really enforcing any of these rules? Who is coming in as a driver? So we've actually been trying to apply some of those lessons at PwC ourselves. We're opening up a new service delivery center in London, Ontario. where we do the tax work, sort of the basic compliance work, and we're actively trying to look at how we do that intake for people. One of the things that a large company like ours is concerned with is the idea that our brand is being conveyed by people who work for us on a part-time or a freelance basis, and that years ago used to be unheard of. You know, a brand like PwC, we would only have full-timers who went through weeks and weeks of training. I went through a half-hour video to teach me about five-star customer service, but yet, what were the stats, Sunil? It was the customer satisfaction rating for Uber drivers in Toronto was something like 65% versus 25%. Anybody want to venture a guess how many days of taxi driver training there is in Toronto? 17. So I actually tried to sign up for the taxi driver training to at least see the corpus, and there was a four-month waiting list. But kindly enough, Christine Hubbard from Beck gave me a bit of information on sort of what was contained there. They're not apples to apples in terms of what they do, but you know, when it comes to the sort of the customer service, it is very interesting what happens on the job versus front-loading all of this training. By the way, I was attending monthly webinars. When's the last time your taxi driver told you about a webinar that they were on about sort of how to understand the data on their phone or understanding new services that were being rolled out? There was opportunities to learn about Uber Pool during the Pan Am Games, things like deliveries being rolled out even this week. So the second point was around feedback, and this is two-way feedback with consequences. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about the driver ratings and sort of how they ensure this quality. In my experience, any driver that I had talked to that was dipping below about a 4.3 out of 5 stars were being asked back into the office. They would go through the training again with somebody one-on-one. And if they didn't improve within a series of about a few weeks, they would actually be taken off the platform altogether. So your app gets suspended. That's the first way that you tell. And there's a lot of data in what happens in the feedback. So when you, as a passenger, give a driver 3 stars or below, you are prompted for what is the nature of the deficiency? Do you believe that they took the wrong route? Was there an unclean car? Was there another issue? And typically, if you're rating somebody in sort of that 2 range, Uber will typically compensate the passenger without question, and they will actually pursue this with the driver. And if the driver's found still not at fault, they will actually eat that cost. But it is interesting where they have the data to look at things like optimal route. So did I take traffic into consideration? You know, we had some drivers in Toronto who were actually coming from London, Ontario, which is, a 2.5-hour drive, to drive in the city of Toronto because they felt that GPS could really take the place of local knowledge. And it does to a certain degree, but not enough really to justify somebody who has no knowledge of where there might be traffic or some optimal routes. Now, this is, you know, very painful for the London cab drivers who spent something like 2 years acquiring the knowledge and now being replaced by this idea that a GPS can do a lot of these things. So this, for example, is what I see as the driver. So I have an app on my dash, and it gives me an 8-second countdown. So when I think about the passenger ratings, and most drivers that I talk to, and I get to have these conversations with drivers because I use the same language that they do, I've developed that sense of trust that when I'm a passenger, I can talk to them about what they do. So we talk about when you rate a passenger down. And typically, it's only if somebody is making you wait an inordinate amount of time. So if any of you know, the city of Toronto has been cracking down on a lot of the congestion on the main arteries. So if you are a driver and you're parking on one of the main north-south throughways, you're going to get ticketed, you're going to be asked to move along. So having a passenger blow-dry their hair and have you wait another 10 minutes before you can turn it on creates an issue, and you'll rate passengers down accordingly. And if you're in a university town, you know, there's a few people who try to bring in what used to be called a traveler. You know, they've got the beer stuffed in their pocket, and, you know, they're spilling things, or they're just messy in your back seat. This is people's own personal cars. They care about the wear and tear on their car, and they will rate those passengers down. So passengers who are rated down over time will be asked by Uber to actually leave the system. They will be given a warning. And nowadays, Uber is actually made more transparent. You can request your passenger rating from Uber. And I'm, even though Maureen Dowd in the New York Times was worried that her passenger rating went down because she didn't talk to the driver, I can assure you that's the least of our worries. We don't need to have a conversation with every passenger. But what we do care about is that we can make a living and that our personal car can be used for our family trips to the grocery store on the weekend. So this is how I was making decisions. I didn't see where you were going before I picked you up, but I had 8 seconds to decide. So if this rating that pops up on the bottom of the screen, whoops, if that rating is a below a 4.3, very similar to the driver ratings, I'm more than likely to actually pass you by. I will actually let that count down past 8 seconds, and I will ignore that fare. So that means that that passenger is going to wait longer on a rainy, busy night because their particular passenger rating is poor. And I've actually talked to people who said, you know, I thought I've waited a long time. I really need to find out my passenger rating. Maybe there's something I should be doing about this. My wife was one of those people who said that the other day. So, you know, and interestingly, one of the things by not showing driver full information about destination is that you avoid some of the problems that you see in cities where cabs hate short trips. And unfortunately, there was an incident recently after a nightclub closed in the exhibition place area of Toronto, where a cab driver at a stand had refused a young lady a ride where she was going less than 2 kilometers. Cab drivers aren't supposed to ask you where you're going or deny you a fare for that, but in practice they always do, because they know that the time to get out of that lineup where they were waiting for the next passenger means that they're going to have a very low fare, and it's really just not worth their time. So there's other perverse incentives going on here, but as a driver, I don't see where you're going, so I'm going to take you on a short run or I'm going to take you on a long run. I really don't have the choice within this platform. Yeah. Yeah, so if I knew how to do that, I would... Oh, there we go. So it's synced now. So let me go back one last... So this idea of balancing risk and reward. So it's not like PwC assigned me this. They didn't say, you're innovation leader, go drive Uber for 13 months. In fact, I did an interview on Metro Morning a few months back, and I remember one of the online commentators said, does PwC not pay this person enough? Why would he be driving for UberX? So I was trying to understand sort of what is this balance? Why does a contingent worker, a precarious worker, as they've been called, why would they want to do this? So if I think about the risks, I let people out in the entertainment district, and people got out of my back seat, nobody in the front seat. What do you think that the cab drivers at the stand did when they saw that? They were in my face. They were shaking their fist. They felt that they were granted a monopoly on grand transportation in the city. I was a passenger in an UberX here in Toronto or here in Montreal. I got out of Notman House, where there's a taxi cab stand, and I was doing a similar speech, and we got out into an UberX. Turns out my driver is a Revenue Quebec officer who drives in his spare time. But immediately we were surrounded by local taxi drivers who knew exactly what was happening, and they were taking pictures of this gentleman, his car. And in Toronto, we've actually seen incidents where they will take pictures of people's car, they will post them on the web and on Twitter, and they will copy in all the insurance companies in Canada with hopes that those insurance companies will invalidate those driver's licenses or insurance policies. And there is a risk. Not on the passenger side. I have seen enough of the situation where I do think that the passengers are covered on the secondary policy. But on the driver's policy side, you will not find an insurance company who will legitimately insure drivers for this sort of work. There is a secondary policy on the drivers as well, but there is this gap which is pretty distinct, which is when a driver turns on an app looking for a fare until they get somebody in the back seat. So that period from when app is on and I'm in driver mode until I pick somebody up, that is a real question as to whether there is any kind of coverage there. Practically speaking, if anybody gets into an accident at that point, it is very unlikely. You have an empty car. Somebody, police officer, comes to see you. Are they checking your phone to see if you have the app on? Almost no driver would actually volunteer that information that I had the app on. So maybe you might see a regime in the future where you actually ensure that Uber has to actually release that data. Insurance companies may ask for that information and look into that. But what we actually saw was this was an opportunity to engage with the insurance industry in Canada, because we had seen in south of the border there was companies like Metromile and Geico who were actually doing some things where they looked at the very sort of back and forth nature of driving as a commercial driver versus driving as maybe a parent or a personal citizen. So they were using telematics and the Uber Apps API, the application programming interface, to be able to say, I'm going to charge you a commercial rate by kilometer when you have the app on, and I'm going to charge you the personal rate when you're taking your kids to school. And being able to do that fairly, as opposed to the difference right now, which for me was about $3,000 for my personal insurance versus $12,000 and up for my commercial insurance, a huge difference. And for most of the drivers, as Sunil said, they're driving less than 10 hours a week. They're never going to pay $12,000 a year for commercial insurance. So the insurance companies and the regulators needed to understand what were some of these opportunities and risks. Intact is now actively working with Uber to actually put in a policy that makes sense for Canada. I think we'll see other regulators following suit. I think, interestingly, you'll actually have the insurance companies looking at driver ratings, and they'll probably skim off the top of the top-rated drivers, because I think there's probably some correlation there in terms of sort of behavior, you know, routes taken, are they observing the rules of the road? All of those things tend to go into positive driver ratings. So, you know, I've written about this. This was a post I had about a year ago now. 40,000 people read this in 24 hours. People from all sorts of industries, not just companies that thought they were going to be disrupted in the future, but companies like ours that are trying to learn from what is happening here. What are these different lessons that they may be able to apply back to their own businesses? So, you know, we talked a little bit about where we see this going in terms of economic impact. This is sort of the full analysis of the of where the PwC data was. You can find this on our website. We looked at five subsectors, only five subsectors, to make this estimate. So if you think about the services economy in Canada, this could be an even larger effect in terms of the 20 times growth globally. Could be a higher multiple in Canada if you look at the sort of services component within here. So I've been thinking a little bit about breaking down the so-called sharing economy into another piece, because when people talk about sharing, this isn't just purely the bartering of goods. And I think, you know, Mathieu did a very good job of sort of contrasting sort of what is the bartering versus what is a profit-oriented vehicle. So the book, The Uber of Everything, goes into some of these examples. We found 500 companies in 2014 alone claiming to be the Uber of their industry. There are five Uber of marijuana deliveries. There are five Uber of healthcare. I'm not sure why they're the same number. Maybe they're the same company. But we're seeing Uber of gentleman's care. We are seeing the, you know, Airbnb of dating. There's lots of examples. But, you know, we really think that some of these differences are worth exploring in some depth. These, what we are calling the freed market economy in the book, really gets into, are they using technology as a fundamental base as opposed to an add-on app? Are they making the market using that technology? Are they seeking profit in a way that is different and new? So when I look at things like surge pricing or understanding how to pull those levers to get a contingent workforce out when they should be maybe home watching the Super Bowl, they're actually out driving because there is the surge price available to them. And then, you know, this upper left-hand quadrant, this is this idea of the exponential inventory, whether it's people's personal extra bedroom or whether it's extra drivers, this ability to have a small full-time workforce but able to exponentially expand into people who have that free time or other assets. And then finally, this idea of where trust is coming from in this new type of free market economy. We talked a little bit about the nature of where regulators and other institutions had conferred trust. When I gave you that taxi medallion or that taxi license, at one point in time, that would give me trust to get into that particular car. Now we've set the bar at a different point about what it means to have a quality ground transportation ride in many of these cities. So that trust being conferred has actually elevated the experience of a lot of consumers. So Sunil actually foreshadowed this. This is the Uber of elder care. This is actually a company called Room to Care, targeting people, or maybe it's the Airbnb of elder care, targeting people who have that extra room and maybe have some ability to take in somebody. Maybe they've got some extra medical training. And if you think of that elderly person who doesn't want to go into sort of a sanitized assisted living center and they want to live with a family, this is a great alternative to them. So I actually think that there is a lot of discussion that can be had beyond just transportation and accommodations. And I want to thank you very much for inviting me here today. So.